Hello and welcome. I'm Evan Spring, and this podcast is called The Afterbeat. It's about the jazz scene in New York City from 1955 to 1964, and the point is to hear directly from people who were there. I'm doing these interviews for book research, but I also want these voices to reach the public directly. In this episode, we'll hear from Bill Crow, the bassist and author, born in 1927. He grew up in Washington State, served in the Army, and then came to New York in 1950 and studied valve trombone with Lenny Tristano. Then in the summer of 1950, he learned to play bass on a job in the Adirondacks. Pretty soon he was playing bass with Dave Lambert, the singer, Teddy Charles, the vibraphonist. Then he worked with Stan Getz for 6 months starting in 1952, so only 2 years after learning the instrument. Then with Claude Thornhill's orchestra in 1953, Terry Gibbs in 1954, Marion McPartland in 1954 into 55. Then that year, Bill Crow started working with Jerry Mulligan. This would become his best-known association. First, he was with the Mulligan Sextet with Zoot Sims and Bob Brookmeyer, then later Mulligan's Quartet and the Mulligan Concert Jazz Band. Around this time, Bill Crow studied bass with Fred Zimmerman, who played with the New York Philharmonic. Zimmerman taught other jazz bassists as well, including George Tucker, Leonard Gaskin, and Eddie Gomez. Bill Crow's other employers over the years were Dizzy Gillespie, Eddie Condon, Mose Allison, Pee Wee Russell, Jim Hall, Lee Konitz, Quincy Jones, Thad Jones, J.J. Johnson, Art Farmer, Tommy Flanagan, also singers like Mel Torme, Nina Simone, Chris Connor, and on and on. Bill Crow has written two books, both published by Oxford University Press. One was an excellent memoir called From Birdland to Broadway. The other is called Jazz Anecdotes, which is a book of anecdotes, which might sound like a flimsy premise for a book, but this book gets referenced over and over in the literature. Only a few other books get referenced this often, books like the Miles and Dizzy autobiographies. So in this interview with Bill Crow, we're at his house in New City, New York. I'm using these cheap lapel mics that click a lot, and I've replaced them since then. He also wanted to sit outside on his patio with all his gardening around us, so you'll hear some traffic noise and bird calls. So now for the first clip. As I said, Bill Crow came to New York in 1950, and when he got here, he went right to Birdland on Broadway between 52nd and 53rd Street. I come across the same story over and over again. The musician arrives, stashes their suitcase somewhere, and goes right to Birdland that night. So here's what happened to Bill Crow.
My first experience with Birdland, there was Charlie Parker on the stage with Red Rodney and Bud Powell and Roy Haynes and Tommy Potter. And the house band was Miles Davis, Sonny Stitt, J.J. Johnson, Al Haig, Curly Russell, and Max Roach. So with all that talent on the bandstand, the house was full of musicians. You look down the bar and there's Ben Webster and Lester Young and Joe Jones and Art Tatum, unbelievable.
So Birdland was the most prestigious venue for modern jazz at that time. And through all the 50s and into the 60s, it was the premier place in Midtown. In this next clip, Bill Crow is talking about rents and real estate like a real New Yorker.
Well, I found a furnished room on 8th Avenue, a block from Birdland, that was $8 a week, and complete with cockroaches. And I was very happy to have that. And then about 2 weeks after I lived there, I met a drummer who was studying art at the Art Students League. He had a place on 84th Street, someplace like that on the west side, that was $12 a week that he was willing to split with me, so I cut my cost down to $6. And of course, I didn't do much except go to Birdland because Bird was there and all of those people. But I bummed around. I lived with John Benson Brooks for a while after I met him. And then I finally had to find a place to live. So. I lucked into this place on Cornelia Street. It was $50 a month for a studio apartment that they were calling it. It was really just half of a railroad flat. So after I'd been in there for a couple of weeks, I guess it was, guy from upstairs comes down and says, you paying $50 a month? I said, yeah. He says, I think they're ripping us off. This is supposed to be rent controlled. So he said, I'll call them downtown and see what they think. So about a week later, this guy shows up with a clipboard and he looks around and says, studio apartment, are they kidding? And he writes something and says, I'll see it. Then I get a letter saying, from now on, your rent will be $28.80, which included the increase. So that was just a gift from heaven, because it meant that if I got a job on the road, I could just lock the door. I didn't have to look for a...
So how long did you have that for?
Well, I kept it for about 10 years. Over the years, they added heat. Originally, it was just the fireplace with hot and hot water. And the toilet was in a little closet between my apartment and the neighbor. And you'd go in and hook their door and use it and remember to unhook it again. And they did come and put a toilet in my back room. So by the time I left there, the rent had crept up to $65 a month, I think it was.
Yeah. And so you lived in the village, and yeah, it probably felt a little bit more like a small town.
Oh yeah, back then. In fact, you know, there was a sandal shop there on West 4th Street where I bought a pair of sandals, and I got some shorts, and I was out one day looking for some kind of a part, a plumbing part, something like that. So I wandered around the village, and then I got a little farther uptown, and all of a sudden I realized, boy, I'm really dressed inappropriately for this part of town. The village was quite different in those days.
Yeah.
Well, we did a lot of stoop sitting too. We'd sit out on the stoop on a summer evening, three or four of us, and
well, you probably didn't
appraise the people walking by.
No air conditioning, I imagine.
No, I had a big fan in my window, and there was a night. The apartment looked out into the backyard behind the Waverly Theater, and there was a beautiful, I think it was an ash tree. It had very twinkly leaves. When the wind would blow, that was quite a beautiful thing to have there.
So let's talk about rents for a second. Obviously, artist communities need affordable rents. As you heard, Bill Crow found a studio apartment, or what he called half a railroad flat, in the West Village. I think what he means is that little apartments would be accessed from a corridor like a railroad car. So he found this apartment for $50 a month in the early 50s, and this got lowered to $28.80 by a city housing agency. Adjusting for inflation, early 50s dollars are worth about a tenth what they're worth now in 2019. So today this rent would be about $300 a month. Later, his landlord added heat and a toilet, and the rent went up to about $65 by the early 60s, so this would be about $550 today. Now, these are low rents even for that time, but around 1960 there were plenty of artists living in rent-controlled apartments in the West Village and paying less than $50 a month. Further uptown, Thelonious Monk on West 63rd Street in the mid-1950s was paying $30 to $35 a month for himself and his wife and kids. Randy Weston in 1959 got a six-room apartment on 13th Street for $76 a month. Bob Dylan, around 1961-1962, got a place on West 4th Street for $60 a month. Even adjusting for inflation, you would pay at least five times these amounts if you moved to New York today. Here's another way to look at the cost of living back then. In 1957, Amiri Baraka, who was then Leroy Jones, found a three-room apartment on East 3rd Street, and he paid $32 a month. This seemed like a lot of money to him at the time, considering it was a dodgy neighborhood. But he found a job in a bookstore that paid $50 a week. This would be like getting a $12 an hour job today, which would be less than the current minimum wage. But $50 is $18 more than he's paying in rent. So even after taxes, he could pay a month's rent on a three-bedroom apartment with 1 week of bookstore wages. And so wouldn't that be nice? So moving along, Bill Crow is now talking about the whole jazz social network in Midtown Manhattan. This Midtown social network is mostly gone today, but this was where the musicians hung out and networked professionally.
In terms of musicians, when I first came, I would spend my days hanging out at Charlie's Tavern because I knew that was where the musicians went, in the Roseland building. And just standing on the corner, you know, you would see all your heroes walk by. It was like, wow, Ben Webster, you know, look, there's Joe Jones, you know. And I thought, well, this is New York. That's the way it's always going to be. Yeah. You know? Well, it changed so fast, I couldn't believe it.
Mm-hmm. Even jazz fans walking around Midtown now would have no idea what it used to be like, because you would have not only the clubs like Birdland, but you had the Union Floor, and you had all the recording studios,
And the bars.
And the bars.
The there were four or five of them in those days. I remember some people were doing some kind of study or documentary or something, wanted me to walk them down 52nd Street while they photographed all of the places where the clubs used to be, you know. Well, we started over at Fifth Avenue, and there was nothing there, you know. I said, this is where this used to be. So, but we got up to the building where the Hickory House used to be, which was completely torn down and rebuilt into a giant corporate office building. And I'm saying, well, this was the Hickory House. And a woman comes out in uniform and says, you're not allowed to film here.
Oh, man.
I said, we're on the sidewalk. She says, we own the sidewalk.
And I suppose musicians didn't have answering machines or answering services. Maybe some of them did. So you would actually count on running into each other.
We had a couple of phone services. The main one was Radio Registry, and you would join them, pay them a little monthly fee, and if any phone calls came in, you know, you would put that on your business card or, you know, in the union book, whatever. And if anybody called you, you could call in and see if you had any calls. But also they would book dates, like a contractor might call and say, I need a bass, drums, four trumpets, three saxophones, whatever, you know. And I'd like to have, and they'd name the first call guys. And they would try to get them, but if they weren't available, then they would just go down their list, you know. And I got several dates that way. I got one where Oscar Pettiford didn't show up, and they called me, and I got there in 10 minutes because I had a motor scooter.
I get asked about 52nd Street a lot, but the era we're studying here is 1955 to 1964, and basically 52nd Street was dead by 1955. It was all strip clubs giving way to office towers. The heyday for 52nd Street was the swing and bebop eras, so mid-30s to late 40s, and it was concentrated on one block between 5th and 6th Avenue. By 1954, there was only one jazz club left on that block. It was Jimmy Ryan's, a Dixieland place. Jimmy Ryan's lasted until 1962 at that location. There was also the Hickory House, but that was between 6th and 7th Avenue, so it was closer to the Times Square area where Birdland and the Metropole and the Palladium were. So 52nd Street is basically gone, but you still have a Midtown scene to the east and to the west. To the west is where the musicians would network and hang out, near and above Times Square. To the east, you have some jazz venues that are more posh. The best known was the Embers on East 54th Street. So I asked Bill Crow about those clubs in the East 50s.
My whole experience with jazz was the West Side, I guess, from Birdland to the Half Note, you know.
I guess the Hickory House was sort of the one place kind of in the middle. I guess it would kind of link those worlds.
Yeah. But when I first came here, I didn't know too many places to go. But I joined the union. I transferred from the Seattle Union. And 3 days a week, the union had an exchange floor where people would come for a couple of hours to see if they could pick up some work. And they had a system where the guy up on the stage had a microphone. He would call people's names, and they would come and say, such and such a contractor wants to see you. And contractors would be roaming around. When I first went there, I was charmed to see that there are all kind of jazz players standing over in this one side of the room. Alan Eager and, you know, a lot of different people. So I would go hang out with them, but then I realized that there was no work happening over here. So I went down to the other end where the contractors were and started getting acquainted with people. There were some people that would even go up and tell the announcer to announce their own name. It's just so people would hear it, you know.
So it was Wednesdays in particular, right?
That well, it was Monday, days. Wednesday, and Friday. And Wednesdays were big because most of the Saturday night work was booked on Wednesdays. Friday was desperation time when last-minute jobs came in and everybody was booked, you know, then they'd have to really scratch, yeah. Try out people they hadn't used before, that kind of thing. And I got in on a few of those kind of jobs.
Were there any jobs that actually you considered good jobs that you got there, or were mostly just routine?
They were mostly routine, although since I was a brand new bass player, I had just learned to play the instrument. Every job was a lesson, you know, so. But once in a while you'd get a bunch of lame players and would just be put in your time and get out of there, you know.
Yeah.
But after the union on those 3 days, then everybody would go over and hang out at Charlie's Tavern. And Charlie's had become the place where all of the road musicians hung. They could pick up their mail there and they could see who was in town and all of that, you know. There were a couple of other bars then, but I didn't get to know Jim and Andy's until some years later. That was the recording musicians bar. And there was another one called Beefsteak Charlie's. It was a couple of blocks south of Charlie's Tavern, where most of the uptown black musicians would come down and hang out when they felt like they needed to be midtown for some reason, you know.
When you were sitting around these places talking about the union, was there, what was the general opinion of the union among the musicians?
Oh, we felt that they were corrupt. The old administration, the tendency was that if somebody started any kind of a movement to improve things, he would be on the blue ticket next time. They would just absorb him, you know.
And I see.
They took care of the Philharmonic and the recording industry and the main club date industry, but they didn't help out the jazz musicians much at all.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, when they found out during the war that a lot of the clubs on 52nd Street were just hiring a rhythm section because they knew so many horn players would come and sit in, they started sending delegates around to stop them from jamming, you know. Well, that wasn't productive at all. The musicians wanted to play together, you know. So,
was there a basic classification problem where classical music would be classified as a concert, so it would have its own set of union policies, and then
jazz would be
classified as popular entertainment or a variety show?
Each field had separate contracts negotiated with management. And that's why it was so complicated when we computerized the union when we took over, because you had to write all of this, you know, you couldn't just use a standard union contract because there were different things in each one of these contracts that had to be abided by.
But musicians were paying attention to the actual policies then more than now?
I don't say, there were always a couple of firebrands who would be like stirring up, you know, saying we got to do this, we got to, and when the union elections would come up, there would be some of these guys that would try to get changes made, and it got so bad, one time I remember they, at a bylaw meeting, he's got, that's the Carolina Wren. They took a vote and absolutely miscounted, you know, they instead of counting or having a ballot, they just said, well, all of the ones that are for it say aye, and the ones that are against it, and then they say it's passed, you know. So that was terrible. And they had a tremendous amount of support from retirees who didn't work much anymore, who supported the old regime, and they would bus these guys in at the meetings, and they changed it to voting by mail ballot, which made it easy for all of these retirees to vote for them. And it took a lot of changes in the the actual structure of the union, and how many people belong to it anymore, and mm-hmm. before the rebels really were able to mount a, you know, John Glazell was remarkably good at figuring out strategies for that sort of thing, and when we ran a ticket, finally, the whole ticket got elected. It was amazing. So I was on the board there for about 20 years, you know, and then I disagreed with one of the choices that they made for the next presidential candidate. So I stopped being on the board, and I just worked in the office there for 3 days
so,
a week.
So this was later. This is in the 80s or?
Yeah, 80s, 90s.
Mm-hmm. Back in the late 50s and early 60s, it's kind of striking just as a matter of representation. I can't think of any musicians, named jazz musicians, who were delegates or had any power in the
union. No, the only named musician I ran into when I first went to the union was Andy Kirk, oh, yes. who was working in the office there. A very nice man. I started collecting records when I was in junior high school, and I had a lot of Andy Kirk records, and so I was very impressed that he was there.
One more union question is about the Performance Trust Fund. This is something that never seems to come up in jazz history at all, uh-huh. even though it was a pretty gigantic fund that James Petrillo
yeah.
started.
Yeah, he forced it on the recording industry. It ended up creating some work for guys, but it ended up just being kind of a little stipend for locals that no longer had any work. So they would be able to take care of a few of their members with some of those jobs. Mm-hmm. But so, in the days when there were locals in every little town, because there was a ballroom in every town, and so there was a tremendous amount of traveling work.
Yeah. So someone like you, who was well employed in the studios, generally those musicians, they knew that a lot of their own union dues were being diverted to this fund, so there was a natural...
Well, it wasn't so much. It was. It wasn't so much their dues. It was raises that they might have gotten that instead were negotiated for contributions to the trust fund. But the one thing that I benefited from tremendously was when I started doing Broadway shows. After the war, there was a tax on theater tickets. And Judge Turkus, when they took that to court, Judge Turkus said, all right, we'll do away with the tax, but you've got to create a pension fund for your employees. This wasn't just the musicians, it was all theater employees. So each of the unions figured out some way to use this award, and fortunately he didn't put a dollar amount on it, he put a percentage amount on it. So when the theater ticket prices went up, we benefited tremendously. That got me a very nice pension mm-hmm. from 10 years of doing Broadway shows. You know.
Looking back on the 50s and 60s, was there any localism of Local 802 that had any significant effect on the jazz world there? The waiting periods or the surcharges on traveling bands or anything that, in retrospect, you might have done differently if you were in charge?
The waiting periods were established in the days of more traveling bands, really, and I could understand how the logic behind it, but it was tough. Like when you showed up and transferred, I put in my card from Seattle, and I had to wait 6 months to be able to take a steady job. Well, nobody was offering me a steady job anyway, but I was supposed to stay in New York during that 6 months and not travel. And then right away I get a summer job up in Tupper Lake, New York. So I had to pretend that I was in New York and come back in once in a while to check in with the union, you know, and then go back up. But that was over soon, and then I was a full-fledged member.
Yeah, I heard some musicians would fake old rent receipts and utility bills and stuff
yeah.
to pretend they had been in New York for longer.
Yeah, yeah.
When Bill Crow mentions working the Broadway shows, that was in the late 70s and 80s, and he was doubling on tuba. And when he talks about serving on the executive board of Local 802 in New York, that was from 1983 to 2003. But the Union Rebellion he spoke of, that got started back in 1963, and it was directed against the New York branch of the AFM, Local 802. The American Federation of Musicians was unusual in that most of its members did not support themselves as musicians. Most of its members were amateurs or part-timers or retirees. This is very uncommon for a union. You don't find amateur steelworkers in a steelworkers union. So in this rebellion in 1963, to simplify, you had the active working musicians like Bill Crow leading the rebellion. They were the ones generating most of the revenue for Local 802 through a work tax of 1.5%. And the union administration, to save their jobs, aligned themselves with the less active membership. The annual dues were quite low, just $24, and this favored the less active musicians, who were also subsidized by a union trust fund that sponsored concerts. So the active working musicians wanted to lower the work tax and raise the dues. They also started a rival publication in March 1963 called The Musician's Voice. The official publication of Local 802 was Allegro, and it's still called Allegro. But Bill Crow did some writing for this new publication, and there's some interesting stuff in there. You just have to go to the New York Public Library to find it. Another wrinkle here is that the trust fund I referred to wasn't only for amateur concerts. Sometimes the AFM did sponsor jazz concerts by musicians we know and love, just not very often. This trust fund was officially called the Music Performance Trust Fund, and no one talks about it now, but it was a big funding source. It started in 1947, and by 1963 it was spending $6 million a year. This is for the whole country, not just for New York, but that was a lot of money. Almost every time you bought a record, a cent or two would go into this trust fund. Or whenever film studios or radio or TV networks or ad companies hired musicians, a tax went to the trust fund. So the studio musicians were subsidizing other musicians who were often part-timers. But long story short, the trust fund had a lot of money and certainly could have done more for jazz. Randy Weston founded a group called the Afro-American Musician Society around 1959-1960, and they wanted the trust fund to support more jazz musicians. Then not long afterwards, Weston got paid by the trust fund to do a history of jazz program in public schools and churches. These gigs paid union scale unless the sponsor kicked in more money. There's a Coleman Hawkins live date from 1958 where he played a high school fraternity dance in Jamestown, New York, which is 400 miles from the city. In that case, the trust fund paid scale and the sponsoring organization matched it, so Hawk could get double scale, as he always demanded for record dates. So getting back to the interview, you probably know there was a cabaret card system run by the New York City Police Department during the era we're concerned with, 1955 to 64. These cards were essentially work permits, and the police controlled them. So sometimes musicians like Thelonious Monk and Billie Holiday were denied these work permits because of drug convictions, so they couldn't work in nightclubs in New York. They could play Town Hall or Carnegie Hall or out in the suburbs, but not in a New York City nightclub. This was a terrible system, clearly unconstitutional. I don't think anyone would defend it today. Even the NYPD would never want to bring it back. The law that required these ID cards was rescinded in 1966.
The terrible thing about the cabaret law, they were trying to get at crooks. You know, everybody knew that the nightclub industry was mobbed up. So in order to try to control it, they made everybody that worked in those places have a cabaret card, which was ridiculous. And what are the waiters or the camera girls or the musicians got to do with the underworld, you know? So the way they wrote the law, there were a dozen ways you could lose your cabaret card, and there was no legal way to get one back. Yeah. They hadn't put that in the law. So of course it invited all kinds of payoffs, and it got so corrupt under the original office that was handling it that they moved it over to the police department, but they didn't change the rules, so the police department became corrupt in administrating that law.
A striking element of this story is that the Musicians Union, the AFM, was so passive. Maxwell Cohen, the lawyer who led the effort against the police card system, wrote, quote, "Not a single union official in the entertainment industry, with the exception of Jackie Bright of AGVA, assisted me or sought independently to fight the police card cases at that time. Under pressure from their membership, however, union officials were beginning to grumble slightly about the card system, end quote. AGVA was the American Guild of Variety Artists, and that was a separate union from the AFM. They had some singers like Dinah Washington. Singers generally were not in the AFM. Anyway, in the next clip, I asked Bill Crow about the time he served as a jazz critic for the Jazz Review, which was published from 1958 to 1961. The editors of the Jazz Review were Nat Hentoff and Martin Williams, and they wanted the Jazz Review to be the first serious highbrow jazz journal.
Well, their idea was to get musicians to do some of the criticizing, and I thought it would be a good idea, but I really am kind of sorry that I did it, because I found out that it's too easy to wound people from that position, you know, and it just was like a conflict of interest, you know.
Well, it seems maybe it was just part of the time that even all the established jazz writers at that time suddenly writing this first highbrow magazine were just got a little carried away with the criticism.
Yeah.
There were a lot of snotty reviews.
Yeah.
Along with the great stuff that was written. But also, I know the one you mentioned that the one you regretted or the one that made you really think twice about it was a review of Tony Scott.
Yes.
Where you took a very harsh position.
And well, it's really funny. I took that position because Tony seemed so strong. And it seemed like he was just like overpowering everybody with bullshit, you know. Mm-hmm. And so I thought I'd say so. And then his reaction to it was to leave the country. And he carried that with him for years, you know. We finally met again after I got elected to the executive board. He came to a meeting that we had, was back in the country for the first time in years, and he said, you know, I don't know what that was all about. He said, but you really gave me hell. And I said, well, I guess I did, but you know, life goes on. Yeah.
Well, I actually love that review. Maybe you would change the tone of it now. I understand why people responded to it negatively. Bill Evans wrote and said,
"Yeah,
it was
Well, he knew Tony in a way that I didn't. Tony had I'd played with him a few times, and he'd always come on real strong, and he took jobs on piano when he couldn't play piano, things like that, you know, and." Or he would come down and signify like mad when Count Basie was playing at Birdland. I wanted to hear the band, and I didn't want to hear Tony saying, yeah, you know. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So I just felt that since he was riding so high, somebody needed to say the other thing, you know. And I just didn't realize that it was going to cripple him to that extent, and I'm sorry that it did.
You know, I read all the reviews you wrote back then, and
the one I liked best was the Wilbur Ware review, I think.
Yeah, I remember that.
That was...
I noticed, too, that they let you review people like Bob Brookmeyer and Art Farmer, who were your colleagues, that there wasn't the same concerns about conflict of interest.
Yeah, yeah. I know, I got a couple of funny, snide remarks from Paul Desmond, too, for something that I had said about them.
Well, rather than focus on the negative reviews, too, I see one here on Art Farmer where you're saying, it's a pleasure to hear such purposeful and unpretentious use of dissonance. He's one of a handful of horn players who find superimposed dissonant scales a source of beautiful melody rather than weird affectation. Also a rarity among musicians his age is the depth of expression that comes through his sound alone. Rather than placing all of his concentration on the relationship of combinations of notes, he often finds as much beauty in tenderly sustaining an almost vocal tone quality on a single pitch. Whatever his approach at a given moment, his playing is consistently affirmative, affluent, animate.
Well,
all of the Jazz Review can be read online for free, and I'll post a link to that. Many musicians besides Bill Crow wrote for the Jazz Review, including Cannonball Adderley, Danny Barker, Bob Brookmeyer, Art Farmer, Benny Golson, Chuck Israels, Bobby Jasper, Quincy Jones, Dick Katz, George Russell, Cecil Taylor, Dick Wellstood, and Bob Wilbur. Moving right along, we're talking about the two leading American jazz magazines in the 50s, Downbeat and Metronome.
Oh, well, Metronome seemed to be more like hip. They approved of bebop sooner than any of the other writers. Downbeat was just like the road musicians, keeping track of who was playing with what band and where the bands were playing, and articles about the girl singers and that sort of thing. But Metronome really wanted to get into more critical dealings with the music, but unfortunately their critics weren't that good at it, you know. Was Bill Koss in Metronome, or was he in...
Bill Koss was the editor, and then
yeah,
shortly before its demise, there was a guy named Dave Solomon who tried to make it even hipper.
And
by
there
doing
was another critic that was lives. Had a lot of creds, but I thought he was a little over the edge. And I remember Bill Koss had favorite phrases that he used in almost every review, you know, that were like meaningless. And I knew George Simon a little bit, you know. I met him through Marion McPartland. He was a nice man. And I knew Gene Lees very well, of course.
The critic he thinks was over the edge was probably Barry Ulanoff, who could be a little pretentious. In the mid-50s, he did a series of articles called Morality and Maturity in Jazz, where he compiled reading lists of literature and philosophy that jazz musicians should check out, that kind of thing. There were other pretentious Metronome critics, but Crow was thinking of someone with lots of creds, as he put it, and Ulanoff was teaching at Barnard College in the 50s. Next up, we're talking about Jerry Mulligan's Concert Jazz Band, which formed in 1960 and was together off and on until 1964. They made 5 LPs for Verve Records.
When I joined the Concert Jazz Band, at one of the rehearsals, he said, "Now look," he said, "this band is based on the quartet, and I want to be able to play like I play with the quartet. And so our dynamic level is never going to be triple forte." He said, "We can have as much dynamic effect by moving from mezzo piano to forte as we can moving from forte to triple forte. And the value of the lower level is that you'll be able to hear the inside parts better." You know? So I thought that was a brilliant analysis of what it was that he wanted to do. And then also he liked to keep the thing more quartet-y in the quartet he would always be playing a counterline of some kind, backgrounds, and he liked to match those to the bass line as much as he could. So whenever anybody was soloing, it would just be Mel Lewis and I and the soloist. Inside of a half a chorus, Jerry would be playing some backgrounds. So it got to be that when Jerry started to play a background, the rest of the saxophone section would harmonize it. And then Clark might throw in a little counter riff and the rest of the brass section would harmonize it, or Brookmeyer would think of something. And so it got to be the tradition that on all of the rhythm arrangements, when there were a lot of solos, we never went into the next written section until Jerry gave us the signal. And so that way these things could develop. Sometimes there'd be 5 or 6 more choruses with just developing the backgrounds and letting the soloist go, you know. Mm-hmm. So it meant that every time you played the tune, it was different, you know. It was really nice.
So with the legacy of that band in particular, do you think maybe just the timing was off because...
Yeah.
The
big bands were not... see, the reason that it existed in the first place was that Jerry made a deal with Norman Granz, so that Norman would pick up the losses in this country if he could have the concert tours and the recordings where he could make a profit.
I see.
Well, that worked out great, and the band agreed to work for the least money that each guy could afford. People with families had to have a little bit more, you know. And Jerry kept the costs down as much as he could. But just about the time Clark and I joined the band, we did a week at the Vanguard, and some college tours and another week at the Vanguard where we recorded. And then we did a thing down in Fort Lauderdale for Hell Week when the college kids are all down there. And at that, while we're down there, Jerry gets a note from Norman that he's selling Verve and the deal is off. So Jerry looked at his book and says, I don't have anything for the band until next month in Boston. He said, I can't afford this. So he broke the band up and we went back to being a quartet with Bob. And then whenever he could, we would go into Birdland. We still kept rehearsing once a week up at Lynn Oliver's, like a free rehearsal, you know. And during those rehearsals, we got even additions to the book. See, that band originally was formed out in California on some movie money that Jerry made. And then he came out here and made the deal with Norman and did a tour with Zoot over there in Europe. It was a big success. And
I've listened to most of those recordings, and I really love the bands. Every once in a while, this may seem like a cranky thing to say, but sometimes when I listen to them, I think maybe Jerry's taking too many solos, and maybe his piano playing is not, maybe he wasn't necessarily the best piano player.
No, he wasn't. No, he indulged himself. What? It was his band, you know. Yeah. But when I first joined the sextet, John Early was complaining that he wasn't getting enough to play. And Jerry said, oh, geez, I'm sorry, John. But he said, you know, it's my band, so I'm going to take the most solos. And he said, Zoot's here, and he's my favorite tenor player, so he's going to get the next most. Yeah. And Brookmeyer, I can't keep him without giving him enough to play. So yeah. He said, you're just going to have to take what's left.
Yeah,
but at least he was honest about it, you know.
So here's a passage of Bill Crow on bass from a live recording called Jerry Mulligan and the Concert Jazz Band at the Village Vanguard. It's on Verve Records, and it was recorded live in December 1960. The piece is called Blueport. I'll fade in for the bass solo, then you'll hear a series of exchanges between Jerry Mulligan on baritone and Clark Terry on trumpet. The drummer is Mel Lewis. Thank you.
Now it's funny, on reissues, I think they remastered that album that the concert jazz band made at the Vanguard. And when it came out, I started getting phone calls from people like Johnny Mandel and Steve Swallow saying, "Man, you sound so great on that album." And I said, you know, it didn't occur to me that I was that kind of a presence, but I think they must have boosted the bass up a little bit. Mm-hmm. So that it becomes more noticeable because I was playing unamplified, you know, and they were recording. I don't think they had a mic right on the bass.
Well, when you're listening to records from that era, you can probably tell that some new pickup is being used, or the sound is coming a little more from the amplifier than from the instrument itself.
Well, it was funny, for basses, when they first started recording basses, that old birdcage mic that the announcers used to use, it made their voices sound low and rich, you know. So they thought that would be good for the bass. But it had a characteristic that if you played really hard, like bass players were playing in those days, it would get the beginning of the note and not the after ring, and just sound like boop, boop, boop. But if you played real soft, it would come and get you, and you'd hear the whole thing, but you were having no effect on the music while it was played, you know. So I fought with that for the first five or six record dates I did. I think the only one that was really weird was that Al Haig album, the two Al Haig albums.
54, yeah.
We did those at Jerry Newman's studio down in the 20s somewhere. And he had one mic. It looked like a little stack of dimes with a black thing. And the piano was open. He had it right over the piano strings, and then he stood me up in the curve of the piano on a box, and put the F hole as close to the mic as I could get it, and then he kept moving Lee Abrams back until he ended up sitting in the doorway to the John, and that was the balance for this trio, one mic.
It sounds like a story from the 20s.
Yeah.
That's funny.
But the first experience I had with really being recorded well was Phil Ramone. We went up to A&R, and he took a Telefunken mic and wrapped it in foam and stuck it in my bridge and said, "There." And I said, "Oh, you know, I don't have to worry about am I on mic, you know." It was great, and it sounded exactly the way I sounded to myself on the playback.
So. I think I heard Scott LaFaro did the same thing, that he liked that better than a pickup, because with a pickup you're getting all this sort of finger rustling on the strings.
And, yeah.
But if you wedge it in there, you get more of the wood resonance.
I went back and listened to that Al Haig session of March 1954 with Bill Crow and Lee Abrams. And to Jerry Newman's credit, the sound is pretty good, and the drummer doesn't sound distant at all. Abrams is on brushes almost the whole session, though, so maybe the single mic setup pressured him to stay on brushes or get banished to the bathroom door. Here's a nice Al Haig solo from that session on Yardbird Suite. Al Haig on piano for the Period record label, March 1954, with Bill Crow on bass, Lee Abrams on drums. So I've been interested in the music of Barbara Carroll, the late piano player, and I asked Bill Crow about her.
And I loved her original nose. I was sorry when she shortened it.
When was that? That was
early 50s. She had a real Grecian bugle, you know. Yeah. It was gorgeous.
Yeah. She was hardly the only one.
Oh, no. Everybody was changing their Jewish names to... I was working with Teddy Cohen, and he called me up one day and said, I'm going to change my name to Teddy Charles.
Yeah.
Oh, no, he said, I'm going to change my name to Charles. And I said, Charlie Cohen, that sounds good. But all of the other Vibes players had done it. Julius Gubenko was Terry Gibbs, and Donald Helfman was Don Elliott.
Yeah.
It was funny, there was an album that came out once that they had taken all the names off the W-2 forms, and so it listed John Haley Sims and Anthony Siaka was Tony Scott, and everybody had a different name.
Changing names in showbiz usually meant anglicizing the name, but I think changing names was more common for everyone back then, especially for singers. Like Eunice Wayman became Nina Simone, or Annabelle Short became Annie Ross. The guitarist Johnny Smith said, quote, everybody I talked to about becoming a professional musician would advise me to adopt a more distinctive name. Well, I hope you've enjoyed this episode. The concept here is pretty simple. 1955 to 1964 was a golden age for jazz in New York City, and we should hear from the people who were there on the scene while we still can. For more information on Bill Crow, check out his website, which is billcrowbass.com. He's got plenty of his writing there, along with a biography and discography. I particularly recommend his piece, To Russia Without Love, which is up on his website. I'll post a link to that. It's about the time he toured the Soviet Union with Benny Goodman in 1962, and is both excruciating and wonderful to read. Thank you again for listening, and please spread the word.